This is Jeff Blankford back in the KZYX studios, wishing you a healthy and productive new year and welcoming you to the January 14th, 2015 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. It is 3 days short of a month since President Obama announced that Washington was renewing diplomatic relations with Cuba, been terminated by President Eisenhower following the confiscation of American-owned properties in 1959 by Fidel Castro's new government in Havana. That only seems like a very long time ago. It was. I was in the Army when Fidel and his fighters swept into Cuba's capital city in 1958, an event that was enthusiastically cheered by the Puerto Rican soldiers stationed with me at Fort Ord near Monterey, many of whom said they were ready to defend the Cuban Revolution if called upon to do so. A number of them, I suspect, were thinking that one day their own homeland, occupied by the U.S. in 1898 when it seized Cuba from Spain, might also have its day of liberation. There is a significant segment of the Puerto Rican community that has never given up on that dream, and many who struggled for it ended up serving years in American prisons. For most Americans, the fight for Puerto Rican independence is unfortunately a non-story, which is why at the time in the change in our relations with its neighbor Cuba, I mention it here. At the time of the Cuban Revolution, the U.S. Army was one of the few sectors of American society that offered Puerto Rican men a place in it which hard work would be rewarded, and the racism, while it existed, was less overt. Unfortunately, not much has changed since then for the people of that island, far closer to South America than it is to Florida. For Cuba, what the new relationship will be with the United States is not clear. Is there a genuine change in U.S. policy toward the island nation whose government has attempted to overthrow and which has unsuccessfully tried to isolate for more than five decades? Or are we seeing simply a change in strategy and tactics? That's what I'll be examining at 20 minutes past the hour when I expect to get a call from Professor Miguel Tinker Salas at Pomona Claremont College in Southern California, who has been my guest several times before in the past, speaking on U.S. Latin American relations. On Christmas Eve, the prospects for a change in policy seemed bleaker when the State Department announced it was making $11 million available for domestic or foreign-based organizations that would carry out operations within Cuban society similar, apparently, to those most recently conducted in the Ukraine, in Egypt before 2011, and two decades earlier than that in what was then Yugoslavia. If Washington's timing of the announcement was designed to make sure it would be ignored by the media, its plan was a stunning success, since, apart from a few bloggers who closely follow Cuban developments, there was not a single mention of the grants in any U.S. media. That's why I've chose to go over some details of the announcement, which I'll be discussing with Professor Tinker Salas in more general terms. According to the announcement, the State Department's Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor expects to award up to $11 million in grants, ranging from $500,000 to $2 million each. The Bureau of Human Rights and Labor, whose acronym is DRL, and of which I was previously unaware, says it is looking for statements of interest, or SOIs, from organizations outlining programs that will foster civil, political, and labor rights in Cuba. According to the announcement, quote, DRL invites organizations to submit SOIs for programs that promote internationally recognized individual civil, political, and labor rights as set forth in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other international agreements in Cuba. The Cuban government, it asserts, fails to respect freedom of speech and the press, restricts internet access, maintains a monopoly on political power and media outlets, circumscribes academic freedom, and maintains some restrictions on the ability of religious groups to meet in worship, end quote. Well, that statement, while containing elements of truth, describes a number of America's allies who are guilty of such charges to a far greater degree. We go on. The government, the announcement continues, refuses to recognize non-governmental human rights groups or permit them to function legally, end quote. The government continues, it says, to prevent workers from forming independent unions and otherwise exercising their labor rights. Common human rights on the island, it says, include those involving the abridgment of the right of citizens to participate in their government, including through periodic and genuine elections, as well as the use of government threats, extrajudicial physical violence, intimidation, organized mobs, harassment, and detentions to prevent free expression and peaceful assembly, end quote. All of that is, again, true of some of Washington's allies and in a far more injurious manner than one finds in Cuba. Well, in addition, says the announcement, the government continues to engage in or permit the following abuses: short-term, arbitrary, unlawful detentions and arrests, harsh prison conditions, selective prosecutions, and denial of fair trial. End quote. Well, this coming from a government which invented the concept of rendition and legitimized torture is quite remarkable. It goes on, quote, authorities also interfere with privacy, engaging in pervasive monitoring of private communications without legal authority and with impunity, end quote. Who writes these announcements? I could just imagine John Stewart's face and his comments if he would read this. And then we go on. DRL programs in Cuba aim to strengthen on-island independent civil society capacity to further the rights and interests of Cuban citizens and to overcome the limitations that have been imposed by the Cuban government on citizens' civil, political, and labor rights. In particular, programs should support the realization in Cuba of rights enshrined within Articles 5, 9, 10, 12, 13, 19, 20, 21, and 23 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, among others. It would be nice if some country that didn't claim to be indispensable would examine the limitations on civil, political, and labor rights that have been imposed on certain sectors of American society by Congress and the Supreme Court. To continue, the department's announcement notes that, quote, a highly competitive statement of interest would generally, quote, demonstrate the applicant's experience programming effectively within Cuba or within other closed society environments, end quote. Those are the applications I'd like to see, since a truly closed society would not permit U.S.-funded agencies to operate the way Washington wants these applicants to do in Cuba. That's just part of what was on the announcement, which can be read in its entirety on the State Department website. Applications for grants are due by February 5th. And now to the big story of the day and the past week. 3 million copies of the new issue of Charlie Hebdo have been published, with another cartoon of Mohammed on the cover. And those kiosks and bookstores that were carrying it, as you have probably heard by now, were immediately sold out. This comes as France, as we learn from every media outlet, is still reeling from the murderous assault on Charlie Hebdo, followed by the bloody hostage taking at a kosher supermarket in Paris's Jewish quarter. The grisly nature of the killings right in the heart of Paris, particularly of the satirical magazine's cartoonist, has made people who should know better, including some friends of mine, cry, "Je suis Charlie," or "I am Charlie," as if the dead were fallen heroes, which in no sense they were. Ironically, if they tried to publish the same cartoons of ridiculing Mohammed in this country, as opposed to lampooning those committing atrocities in his name, an important distinction which has not been made, they would have been marginalized and criticized by any number of organizations, including the Anti-Defamation League, and linked with that nutcase preacher who has gone around burning Korans. Neither France nor Charlie Hebdo are examples of free expression, that term which has been bandied about in recent days as if there was not a cloud of censorship hanging over the French media. When it comes to criticizing or satirizing any aspect of the official Holocaust narrative in France, for example, as in a number of other Western countries, those accused of doing so face a hefty fine or jail time, and occasionally both. It turns out that Charlie Hebdo fired one of its writers in 2008 when he refused to apologize for a satirical comment about former President Nicolas Sarkozy's son Jean when he married the daughter of a wealthy Jewish businessman. The writer Maurice Sinet had written with a touch of sarcasm of Jean Sarkozy when the 21-year-old was sued after ramming a scooter into a BMW and the case was dismissed. It's necessary to state that the complainant is Arab, Sinet wrote in reference to the BMW's owner. And that's not all. Jean has just said that he wants to convert to Judaism before marrying his fiancée, a Jew and heiress of the founders of Darty. That's a major French electronics company. He will go far in this life, this little one, added Sine. When Philippe Val, then Charlie Hebdo's editor, demanded that Sine retract his comments, Sine responded that he'd rather castrate himself, although his actual language was a bit saltier. He was then fired and started his own satirical magazine. Even in the midst of the mass show of solidarity with Charlie Hebdo, the BBC succumbed to the same taboo. BBC TV reporter Tim Wilcox is pressured to apologize after saying at the Paris Unity March that Palestinians, quote, suffer hugely at Jewish hands, end quote. On Monday morning, he tweeted, quote, really sorry for any offense caused by a poorly phrased question in a live interview in Paris yesterday. It was entirely unintentional, end quote. Wilcox was covering the Unity March when he responded to a woman's comments about the state of Jews in France, telling her that, quote, many critics of Israeli policy would suggest that the Palestinians suffer hugely at Jewish hands as well, end quote. You understand everything is seen from different perspectives, Wilcox added. Well, preceding Wilcox's remarks, the woman, reportedly a daughter of Holocaust survivors, had told him, quote, we have to not be afraid to say the Jews are the target. A BB spokesperson told the Daily Telegraph in London, Tim Wilcox has apologized for what he accepts as a poorly phrased question. One could well imagine the uproar should a cartoonist draw Netanyahu erasing a swastika on the side of a fighter bomber and replacing it with Star of David. Israeli officials asked for such a cartoon when they began affixing the most well-known symbol of Judaism to its weapons of war, and thus made it fair game for cartoonists. But we haven't seen it because to draw such an image would require more courage in the West than making fun of Mohammed and insulting the great majority of the world's Muslims. The latter are not engaged in terrorism and totally reject, but ridiculing their religion became an obsession for some of Charlie Hebdo's cartoonists, and it unfortunately ended up costing them their lives. But as one imam in France said, condemning the attack, in the Middle East, such attacks against Muslims are taking place every day. Anyway, there is not, nor can there be, I would emphasize, any justification for the atrocity carried out at Charlie Hebdo, but it is important to understand the context in which it took place, which seems to be a problem for the mainstream media and those who claim solidarity with Charlie. We can begin with the history of France and North Africa and the Middle East. It is a sordid one of a ruthless imperialism most notably expressed by the conquering of Muslim Algeria in 1830 and making it into a department of France until it was forced to withdraw after a vicious civil war that ended in 1962. France was also responsible for dividing Syria following World War I and creating Lebanon into what it intended to be a Christian enclave, and the rules it set down for the country's governance has haunted it ever since. It has also been a participant in America's ongoing bombing campaigns against Muslims across the region and in Africa, while hosting the largest Muslim population in Europe, which long before the emergence of Islamic fundamentalism found itself treated as undesirable outsiders. The former New York Times journalist Chris Hedges summed up the problem in the opening paragraph of an article on the subject that appeared on Truth Dig site yesterday entitled A Message from the Dispossessed. Quote, the terrorist attack in France that took place at the satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo was not about free speech, writes Hedges. It was not about radical Islam. It did not illustrate the fictitious clash of civilizations. It was a harbinger of an emerging dystopia where the wretched of the earth, deprived of resources to survive, devoid of hope, brutally controlled, belittled, and mocked by the privileged who live in the splendor and indolence of the industrial West, lash out in nihilistic fury. We have engineered the rage of the dispossessed, notes Hedges. The evil of predatory global capitalism and empire has spawned the evil of terrorism. And rather than understand the roots of that rage and attempt to ameliorate it, we have built sophisticated mechanisms of security and surveillance, passed laws that permit the targeted assassinations and torture of the weak, and amassed modern armies and the machines of industrial warfare to dominate the world by force. This is not about justice. It's not about the war on terror. It is not about liberty or democracy. It is not about the freedom of expression, writes Hedges. It is about the mad scramble by the privileged to survive at the expense of the poor, and the poor know it, end quote. Finally, there's another story that you are not likely to read or hear about anywhere else. It's about the persistent effort of a frequent guest of mine, Grant Smith, director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy, to expose the degree to which Israel has penetrated key American institutions, engaged in illegal uranium smuggling and espionage. His latest efforts are being stymied by the Department of Defense officials who are fighting his three-year-old request under the Freedom of Information Act to release a critical 1987 Department of Defense report that deals with Israel's nuclear technology and U.S. knowledge concerning it. Only the weekly and online journal, The Washington Examiner, has reported the story thus far. Smith filed the request in 2012, and he raised the issue in federal court after he said his request went nowhere. In a seldom-used legal move known as optional review, Pentagon officials want the Israeli government to review the report before the DOD considers releasing it. Smith said the DOD denied being able to locate the report, claimed it contained sensitive Israeli government information, and cited Freedom of Information Act exemptions, non-disclosure agreements, and patents to intellectual property rights in its effort to block its release. While Israel is not obligated to respond, U.S. defense officials said, quote, diplomatic relations dictate that Department of Defense seek Israel's review, according to documents filed January 5th in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Thus, respectfully, if the court were to order release of the information in question before Israel completes its review, Department of Defense would be placed in a difficult position of honoring both the authority of this court and the sanctity of its diplomatic agreements, Pentagon officials said in their court filings. Defense officials pointed to, quote, the extraordinary circumstances present in this case, end quote, to justify the request for more time. While they, quote, admit to delays in their handling of the Freedom of Information Act request, officials insisted they did not stall the process, quote, in bad faith, end quote. The unclassified report in question, titled Critical Technology Issues in Israel and NATO Countries, has surfaced in media stories and nonprofit research, but has never been released to the public, according to court documents filed by Smith. Smith's complaint cited a 1995 publication called The Risk Report, which claimed the United States, quote, approved the sale of powerful computers that could boost Israel's well-known but officially secret A-bomb and missile programs, end quote. U.S. District Court Tanya Chutkan issued an order January 8th requiring defense officials to say by February 12th whether they plan to invoke a non-disclosure provision that would allow them to keep the report secret at Israel's request. If not, Chutkan will begin the process of privately reviewing the report herself.